From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. This week, New York's Lincoln Center is hosting a series of concerts with the legendary jazz composer and saxophonist Ornette Coleman. On today's Fresh Air, we feature archive interviews with Ornette Coleman, with his son Donardo, and with members of his original quartet, bassist Charlie Hayden and trumpeter Don Cherry. In 1959, Ornette Coleman's quartet debuted in New York City and changed the course of jazz, ushering in the free jazz movement. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Poptopia, a new collection of three decades of power pop. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Results of a test firing announced today suggest that the rifle believed to have been used in the assassination of Martin Luther King may not have been the murder weapon. Experts say the bullet that killed King does not have some of the characteristics of bullets test fired from the rifle that is thought to have been used. Lawyers for James Earl Ray, who went to prison for the 1968 shooting, are asking for additional tests on the gun. President Clinton urged Romanians not to let go of their dream to join NATO, saying their country was one of the strongest candidates for membership 2 years from now. Meanwhile, the president says he and Romania's president have agreed to establish a strategic partnership between the two nations.
A partnership important to America because Romania is important to America. Important in your own right, important as a model in this difficult part of the world. Romania can show the people of this region, and indeed people throughout the world, that there is a better way than fighting and division and repression. It is cooperation and freedom and peace.
Speaking in University Square, where dozens of students were killed during the 1989 rebellion which toppled communism, the president praised the political and economic reforms launched by the new government this year. The Senate is debating whether to cut off funds for American peacekeepers in Bosnia, where NATO troops have launched their first crackdown on suspected war criminals. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Wisconsin Democrat Russell Feingold wants to cut off funding for troop deployment as of June 30th, but Feingold's measure is likely to be displaced by a less controversial, non-binding resolution that would declare the intention of pulling troops out of Bosnia in mid-1998 and turning over the peacekeeping responsibility to European allies. President Clinton has pledged to bring U.S. troops home by next June, but members want to express their concern about a mission that continues despite assurances it would end last December. The debate comes as the Senate considers the defense spending bill, which would include additional funds to pay for the deployment. Feingold says U.S. involvement in the Bosnia operation is not only, quote, mission creep, it has become dollar creep. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The main Protestant group in Northern Ireland received praise from Britain for canceling weekend parades through Catholic neighborhoods. The Orange Order made the surprise decision after marches through the Catholic areas this week sparked violent riots. In Bombay, India, at least 10 people, including two children and a woman, were killed when police opened fire on a crowd protesting the desecration of a social activist statue. And search teams in eastern Venezuela redoubled their efforts today to find survivors still trapped in the rubble from an earthquake yesterday that destroyed buildings and killed 68 people. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the stock market is higher on optimism about low inflation. At noon, the Dow Industrials are up almost 50 points at 79.31. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors have been encouraged by news that the level of wholesale inflation unexpectedly fell in June as the producer price index declined for the sixth month in a row. That news sent Treasury bond prices higher and stocks followed suit. Oil well equipment shares advanced after Falcon Drilling and Reading and Bates Corp. announced a merger creating the world's largest owner of offshore drilling rigs. On an otherwise up day, Crown Cork and Seal has lost 11% after reporting disappointing earnings. And MCI has fallen 14% after the company said losses from local phone operations will be twice as much as originally forecast. I'm Doug Krisner.
Chrysler's second quarter earnings are down 53% from a year ago. The automaker says it earned $483 million in the April through June period. It blames a strike at an engine plant for the decline. The results are in line with analyst estimates of 70 cents per share. Toyota Motor Corporation said today it has no intention of curbing its car exports to the United States, despite recent concerns over recurring U.S.-Japan trade friction. The recent surge in Japan's car exports to the U.S. was a factor behind the rise in Japan's trade surplus. A White House report due out today on NAFTA is expected to say the trade deal has had a positive but modest impact on American jobs and wages. The North American Free Trade Agreement went into effect in January of 1994. Today's report is the first formal assessment of that trade agreement. I'm Frank Stachow, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, putting a world of knowledge within your reach with over 160 locations across America. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Tonight in New York, saxophonist and composer Ornette Coleman will perform the last of a four-concert retrospective as part of the Lincoln Center Festival of Exploratory Music, Dance, and Theater. This celebration of Ornette Coleman is just one in a series of recent honors. He was awarded a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant in 1994, and this year he was inducted into the American Academy of Arts and Letters. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we're offering our own tribute to Ornette Coleman. We'll hear from Ornette and his son Donardo, and from two other musicians who played with Ornette, Charlie Hayden and Don Cherry. Today, Coleman's standing as an important jazz innovator is unassailable, but as a newcomer in the late 50s, he was a controversial figure in the jazz world. His band at the time, the Ornette Coleman Quartet, was so rhythmically and harmonically radical that it provoked an uproar among musicians, critics, and listeners, who all jumped into the fray to attack or defend this new music. This is how the group sounded in 1959, playing Lonely Woman from the Ornette Coleman album, The Shape of Jazz to Come. The Ornette Coleman Quartet performing Lonely Woman on the 1959 release The Shape of Jazz to Come from Atlantic Records. It features Don Cherry on trumpet and Charlie Hayden on bass. Charlie Hayden's impact on jazz was both profound and immediate. In 1959, he moved to New York from Los Angeles to become part of the quartet. In 1985, he told Terry Gross about his first encounter with Ornette.
I was 19 years old, and we played all day long, and he had a room full of music strewn all over the floor, the walls, the ceiling. He was constantly writing music, and he told me before we started to play, he said, "Charlie, I've written these pieces now, and here's the chord changes. Now, these are the chord changes that I heard inside myself when I was writing the melody, but these are just a guide for you. I want you to be inspired from them and create your own chord structure from the inspiration or from the feeling of what I've written. And that way, constantly, a new chord structure will be evolving, and we will be constantly modulating, and we'll be listening to each other, and we will make some exciting music." And that's exactly what happened.
Were you surprised at how controversial the music was when you started playing it? You know, a lot of people couldn't handle it at all, musicians, listeners.
I was very involved in learning about the playing. We were all involved because it was a brand new language. We didn't even think of it as being a brand new language. We we only thought of it as we're hearing something and we got to play it. And we were constantly learning about what it was we were doing. Things were being born every day out of what we were doing. And there was a lot of controversy around us. When we opened up at the Five Spot in New York, fights used to break out right in the club. People would be putting us down. People would be praising us. The club was packed every night with everybody from different parts of the art world, painters, famous writers, filmmakers, dancers, musicians. I would look out, and standing at the bar would be Paul Chambers, Percy Heath, Charlie Mingus, and they would be looking dead in my eye, you know, and saying, okay, what are you going to do? And I would be playing and have my eyes closed, and one night I opened my eyes, and there was Leonard Bernstein with his ear glued to the front of my instrument. And I looked over to Arnett, I said, what is this? He says, I'll tell you later. And then we were invited to Leonard Bernstein's table. He invited us to the Philharmonic rehearsals, and he couldn't believe that I was self-taught, and he wanted to try and get me to study music. And he was very helpful in me getting a Guggenheim Fellowship 10 years later in composition. But it was like that every night. It was very exciting. The violence wasn't exciting. I mean, one guy set somebody's car on fire one night, I remember. Somebody came back in the kitchen. We were standing talking with Arnett, and I won't say who it was, and hit Arnett in the face. You know, I mean, it was really a very strong excitation time. New things were happening, not only in music, but in people's minds every night from that music, you know. And people were always asking me why I was the only white musician, and I never thought about that until people asked me about it, you know. And but that's the way life is. That's the way human beings are.
Charlie Hayden, bassist in the Ornette Coleman Quartet, from a 1985 interview with Terry Gross. We'll be hearing a more recent interview with Hayden in the second half of our show. In the 1960s, Ornette Coleman led a revolution in jazz. We'll hear from him in a few minutes. At his side during this time was the trumpeter Don Cherry. Cherry died in 1995 at the age of 58 of liver failure caused by hepatitis. He spent the first part of his career in the 50s and the early 60s with the Ornette Coleman Quartet. Terry spoke with him in 1990.
When you played with the Ornette Coleman Quartet at the Five Spot in 1959, the music you were playing was considered very revolutionary. And some people really loved it, and other people thought it was, you couldn't even call it jazz. Would you share one of your memories of what it was like then to be in the middle of all this controversy?
Yes, well, what's interesting about that is that when we came to New York in the winter of 59, everyone came from Leonard Bernstein to Thelonious Monk. And like you say, some people loved it and some people hated it, didn't like it. And there would be arguments and fights, and a lot of different scenes have happened. And I remember one night Charlie Mingus bringing Phineas Newborn. And Phineas Newborn has perfect pitch. You know, you can have relative pitch or perfect pitch, and he had perfect pitch. And Charlie Mingus wanted him to play with us. And there was a piano there, so Charlie Mingus had brought Phineas Newborn to set in with us. And we started the set, and Charlie Mingus set Phineas Newborn in front of the piano. And the whole set, we had played four or five tunes, an hour set, and Phineas just stood up there and looked at the piano while we were playing and didn't play a note. And at the end of the set, Mingus came up on the bandstand while Phineas was sitting there, and he took all his elbows and hands and put all the notes on the piano. Like that. And he said, that's where it is. It's all there.
Is one of the reasons why Ornette Coleman didn't use a piano in the quartet of the 60s because everybody was playing slightly off-key intentionally, you know, slightly sharp or whatever, you know, and a piano was tuned, and you couldn't get between notes on a piano.
And you're saying, yeah, the tempered. It's a tempered instrument.
Tempered, yeah, exactly, yeah. Thanks.
And actually, this is something else I've learned, and it's funny how certain things you're involved in and you don't really understand, but you feel it's of value, and later on in years you understand. is from studying Indian music again, we realized there's 36 notes in an octave in Indian music. And the semitones, the minitones, are called shrutis. And we, pitch is one particular reason of not using the piano, because of us working with tones and not just notes, and the different ways of tuning. But one of the reasons of not using the piano, I can also see, is the freedom of a percentage of improvisation. What I'm saying is that you can improvise and go in more directions by not having a piano. If there is a piano player that has the ear enough to know the voicings and can be able to voice it in a way where that you can hit those in-between tones or voices that would, which I know Thelonious could and Abdul Ibrahim Dalabran can.
You used to play in unison with Ornette Coleman on the themes. So it would be trumpet and alto saxophone in unison. But it wasn't the kind of like polished simultaneous playing. You both had tones that sounded like cries in a way. Tell me a little bit about how you'd rehearse and what you'd be going for when you would play in unison on the melody.
Yeah, that's interesting, because now he's really working on something called harmonic unison. But at that particular time, we would learn the compositions frontwards and backwards. And he would write a composition, and I would play the melody, and then Arnett would play with me and write a harmony to the melody. And it's funny, in the harmonic concept, it ends up that when that happens, the harmony that he had written or put with the melody that I was playing would end up being the melody. And the melody that I was playing from the beginning would end up being the harmony. So like an example of that is when we would play with Dewey Redman and myself and Arnett, or Dewey Redman's a saxophone player from Texas that is really fantastic. He's one of the few musicians that really knows the harmonic concept. But it was a period when we would play together, and Arnett would write a third part, and I would be playing the melody, then Dewey would be playing maybe the harmony part that Arnett had written from the second voice, and then he would write a third voice, and it would end up where the third voice that he would write would end up being the melody, and the other two parts that we would play would end up being the harmony.
Don Cherry, speaking with Terry Gross in 1990. Coming up, we hear from Ornette Coleman and his son, DiNardo. This is Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we continue our tribute to jazz artist Ornette Coleman with an interview Terry Gross recorded with the man himself and his son, drummer DiNardo Coleman, in 1995. They spoke following the release of Tone Dialing on their label Harmelotic, named after what Ornette Coleman calls his harmelotic approach to music. DiNardo produced the recording. Here's the opening track.
Free jazz mean to you when you were young? You know, when you were a child.
It didn't mean anything to me.
It just meant more music?
No, I wasn't even aware of it. I was not even aware of free jazz or any categories. You know, like I said, to me it was just a natural sort of experience, just, you know, playing music with my father and the other guys that were playing with him. And, you know, I made some records, and I would actually go and play in some performances, and that was it for me.
You know, when you say free jazz, I feel the same way. I never told anyone I was playing free. In fact, I went to a promoter had hired me to play in Cincinnati, and he had posted around the city a free jazz concert by Ornette Coleman. And the night of the concert, about 5,000 people showed up, and not one had bought a ticket.
They thought it was free jazz,
yeah,
right?
No, yeah.
No admission. DiNardo, can I ask you to share your earliest musical memory of hearing your father's music?
Probably playing together. You know, I think I expressed an interest in playing when I was really young, maybe 5 or 6 or 7. And I wanted to play the drums, and so he got me a drum set, and we just started playing together. And for me, yeah, that's really how I became a musician or learned, you know, what music was about, was just actually playing and listening and being in the environment as, you know, they were rehearsing. And all the people that played with him, you know, particularly the drummers, really were my influence, like Ed Blackwell and Billy Higgins, Charles Moffett. So I was just really right there, you know, in the environment. And again, it wasn't so much saying I really wanted to be a musician as I really just, you know, wanted just to participate. And
why drums? Why did you ask for drums?
You know, I don't know at the time. That was just what I expressed interest in. You know, I don't really remember exactly why. But it just captivated, you know, my imagination at that time.
Ornette, I think the reaction a lot of parents have when a child asks for drums is, couldn't you have asked for a quieter instrument? Did you ever have that reaction yourself?
No, because I think I suggested him to play the drums. I told him, you know, forget about how someone is seeing you through their own eyes or their concept of who they are. Just enjoy what you like doing, whether, you know, I don't think anyone has to please someone in order for them to enjoy what they like to do.
When DiNardo started to play drums, did you think that eventually you'd be in a band together?
Well, actually, I love your questions, because I really feel very bad that I've taken up more of DiNardo's time for him to assist me in what my needs are in relationship to a composer and a performer, because basically DiNardo has his own expression and his own music, and in some way he has put that on the back burner to assist me and his mother.
Do you feel like you've done that too, DiNardo?
No, because, you know, I feel so much a part of what we've done together that to me it's been the same thing. You know, although there's some other things that, you know, that I've been thinking about trying to explore, which is going to be part of some of the other records we're going to be putting out.
DiNardo, when you started playing drums, did your father have any rules about around the house about when you couldn't practice because it would bother the neighbors? You know, the typical drum problem.
No. Although I remember once when we were practicing, like, in the garage. At that point, we were living in Los Angeles. And, you know, I don't know if the neighbors complained to somebody, but there would seem like a whole battalion of police showed up one day. And they were very aggressive.
and they pulled their guns.
They pulled their guns?
Yeah.
I think they were surprised to see, you know, him and I just in the garage rehearsing. I don't know what they were expecting, but, you know, I do remember that.
Did you ever find out who called the police?
No. But, you know, I don't really remember anything else in terms of, you know, being restricted, though.
Well, I guess that taught you a lesson of how angry people could really get. Jeez, I guess it taught you a really different lesson, though, about the police.
Yeah, well, you know.
I don't think it was music. I think it was racial.
Right. Mm-hmm. Ornette, remember you said earlier that you sometimes feel bad that you feel like you've maybe limited DiNardo's options because you've needed him to work with you in the band and managing you and all that. In what sense do you feel like you need DiNardo, that he's doing something that someone else isn't going to be able to do for you?
I love your questions. Because those questions sound to me are are psychological, social, and racial, and everything else. But basically, what I was referring to is the fact that I read in the paper the other day where a brain specialist, a guy went in the hospital and said, this leg is going, this is the leg I want you to take off. Do you know the right leg? And when he woke up, it was the other leg that was taken off. So for me, I would rather work with someone that know what I'm trying to achieve.
Right, right. You know? You feel like with a lot of people, they misunderstand you.
No. I said to know what I'm trying to... for instance, I had an interview with a very good critic in Europe last week, and he said, oh, you know, this music, I really love what you're doing, but I don't understand it. I said, well, I want to ask you a question. If you did understand it, would you love the music better? You know?
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Terry, do you play music or sing?
Oh, I've played a bunch of things badly.
Oh, that's what I thought.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't think you played them badly, but I thought you must be connected to music.
Yeah, no, but yeah, I've played piano badly and French horn badly and clarinet badly.
Uh-huh.
And even a little bit of guitar badly.
Next time we play, bring either one of your instruments to our rehearsals. Maybe we could find something good.
Hey, I sing really badly, too.
Oh,
this sounds great. Say I did that.
Yeah.
What would the first thing be? What would we do?
Well, we would first ask you to do something that you enjoy, that you feel you do well. Then we would play with you.
Oh, that's interesting. So you just kind of play around me.
Well, actually, you know, I was going to ask you if you were a composer. I could give you an example of just how musicians that I asked to do what I'm asking you to do would feel more comfortable doing that. Because, for instance, you know, maybe you have a favorite key or a favorite, for instance, the Bach piece on the record.
Mm-hmm.
When I was looking for a classical guitarist, I had asked Chris Rosenberg which piece did he like, and he said, oh, I like this piece by Bach. I said, well, play it. Then after he played it, I said, you know, I'm going to take my horn and interpret what you're doing harmonically. And when I got through, he said, I want to join your band. So I said, that's just the reason why I did this, so you could see why I'm interested in hiring a classical player. Because if you listen to that piece on the CD, you will see that he's playing it twice, and the second time he plays it, he sounds like he's playing changes for us to play to resolve harmonic ideas. And when he's playing as a solo piece, it sounds like a melody.
Mm-hmm. Although he hasn't changed.
He hasn't changed.
The way
nothing
he's
changed.
It,
not
both
at
ways,
all.
He's playing the same
so
thing.
So you
ways.
Could do that with us very easily, mm-hmm. even if what you call bad.
Ornette Coleman and his son Donardo spoke with Terry Gross in 1995. Tonight, Ornette Coleman performs tone dialing with his band Prime Time at the Lincoln Center Festival. Ornette Coleman's new album, Colors, is coming out in August from Harmelotic Verve. This is Fresh Air. Coming up, more with bassist Charlie Hayden. In 1959, he shook up the jazz world as a founding member of the Ornette Coleman Quartet. He'll tell us about his unlikely start in music, performing with his family on their own country music radio show. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a new collection of power pop recordings. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. In the first half of our show, we heard a 1985 interview with Charlie Hayden, one of the original members of the Ornette Coleman Quartet. In 1969, Hayden launched his own group, the Liberation Music Orchestra, whose music was inspired by democracy movements around the world. 10 years ago, he founded his group Quartet West, whose sound pays tribute to film noir, detective novels, and jazz and pop singers of the 40s and 50s. Hayden grew up in a family of singers who performed on their own country music radio show. Terry Gross spoke again with Charlie Hayden in 1996 about his distinctive interpretation of jazz and how Ornette Coleman influenced his musical development.
Now, when you were young, in your early 20s, I guess, you started playing with Ornette Coleman's group. When you first met Ornette Coleman, which was before he was known to anyone, what was he doing that coincided with what you wanted to do?
I'd been going to a lot of jam sessions and playing in L.A. with a lot of different people, and sometimes I would hear, I mean, I love playing on chord changes. That's the reason that I love this music, and I love improvising on beautiful changes that inspire you, but sometimes I wanted to stay on a certain part of the song and keep playing, and sometimes I wanted to play on the inspiration of a piece rather than on the chord structure, but I mean, I couldn't put it into words back then, but whenever I tried to do what I was hearing, people would get upset, and when I heard Ornette play, that's what he was doing. I mean, that's the way he played all the time.
How do you think your playing was permanently changed by playing with Ornette Coleman?
Well, it wasn't changed. It was really deeply affected. I mean, it was a way that I learned about listening to the musicians that you were playing with at the moment you're playing with them. It's so important to listen to everyone. And that's the way it was really affected by playing with Ornette. Plus the fact that I developed this really strong desire, you know, to play with my whole life on the line, to be willing to give my life for every note I play, that every note is really, really important, each note for people to hear. You know, the reason that we're playing this music is to bring more people to this art form so that they can see that it's a beautiful art form and it can touch their life in a really great way and enhance their life, and that there's an alternative. You know, this music is an alternative for people to know about and to experience. So I think that's why we were all playing. That's why I play now, is to bring people near this art form.
Let's hear something that you recorded with Ornette Coleman. Why don't we hear Focus on Sanity? The listeners who, those listeners who didn't like Ornette Coleman's music, what you were playing with him, found the music discordant. Do you think that there's any contradiction, or is there a connection between the period that you played with Ornette and the kind of really like lush, almost romantic, moody music that you're playing now with your own group, Quartet West?
No, because it's played with the same desire and passion and urgency to make new music, to create something that's never been before. And that's the way all the musicians in Quartet West plays, Ernie Watts and Alan Broadbent and Lawrence Mirable, they approach music that way. And I really don't think that there's that much of a difference in what we're doing in Quartet West and what I was doing with Ornette. I mean, a lot of people have to categorize things, you know, and this is the avant-garde, and this is and this is traditional jazz, or this is whatever. And I really believe that any musician that makes an impact on this art form, or any other art form for that matter, they play beyond, at a level beyond category. So it's all one necessary endeavor to me.
Bassist Charlie Hayden talking with Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. Now back to a 1996 interview Terry Gross recorded with bassist Charlie Hayden.
What part did you sing with your family when you were a boy? And your family had a country music radio show and performed country music all around.
I sang all the harmony parts. You know, I couldn't wait to get to the studio every day. I loved it. Every day my parents would choose the songs that we were going to play out of their vast library of songs from the Carter family and the Delmore brothers and all the hymns that we had. And we would go over them and then we would go on the air. Sometimes we had radio studios in our homes wherever we were living. We moved around a lot, but mostly we would go to the studio at the radio station and do our show every day. I loved going to the studio and I like the air conditioning and the acoustical tile, you know, the acoustical tile and the big windows, you know, that had triple, quadruple glass. And this was back in 1945, 46, 47, 48, 49. It was a great experience.
I can't believe you had radio studios in your home. Would you do remotes from your own home?
Yeah. Where I was born in Shenandoah, Iowa, we were on a radio station there called KMA. It's still there. And my dad moved our family to Springfield, Missouri, in the Ozark Mountains. And my grandparents, my father's mother and father, had a farm outside Springfield, and my dad always wanted to do farming. So he got this farm down the road, you know, gravel road. I went to a one-room schoolhouse there, Bellevue School, and in our farmhouse, my dad had the radio station come out and hook up a remote thing where, you know, those the things that you ring where you turn the crank,
mm-hmm.
you know. Well, he used to turn this crank, and the ring would go into the studio in Springfield, and that was a signal for us to go on the air, and we'd start the theme song. And we did it from our farmhouse for several years before we moved into the city, and went over to the station every day.
So did you play in churches and at revival meetings and stuff in addition to singing on the radio?
We played in churches. We played personal appearances all over. My parents were on the Grand Ole Opry quite a few times.
You know what I'm wondering? If singing at churches and other, you know, other like religious events, revivals, whatever, if that gave you a sense that music had this spiritual potential in it?
Well, the hymns especially that we sing, you know, and then my mom used to take me when I don't know why she chose me to take, but I was the one child. She had six kids, you know, I had three brothers and two sisters. And several Sunday mornings, quite a few Sunday mornings, actually, when I was around 9 years old, she would take me to the African-American church in Springfield. It was just one of them. And we would go in, after everyone was there, we would kind of like quietly go in the entrance, and we would sit in the back row, and we would just listen to the choir. It was like one of the most beautiful things that I've ever experienced in my life, to hear that music, the spirituals and the gospel music, and I'll never forget that. Yes, I had a really early contact with spirituals and hymns, and I had a feeling right away that there was a spirituality in music. I mean, you know, when you talk about jazz, I believe 85-90% of improvisation in jazz is spiritual. You know, it's a spirituality that's you can go to school and learn the academics of music and the fundamentals and scales and chords and composition and all that. But when you start to play and you tell a story to people and you take people on a journey that you want to take them on, it's all about spirituality.
Charlie, a recent album of yours is an album of spirituals, hymns, and folk songs, and it features you with the pianist Hank Jones. It's an album of duets. Are any of these songs that you used to do as a child?
Yeah, we used to do Abide With Me and some of the other hymns that we do, Amazing Grace, on the album.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, every hymn that's on Steal Away, we used to sing, and Hank and I chose which hymns and which spirituals. He had a lot of spirituals. Hank was from the spiritual part of it, and he knew all these great songs. And my favorite one that I've ever heard him play was "It's Me, O Lord, Standing in the Need of Prayer," and that's the one that I heard on the Smithsonian Collection of Jazz Piano. That inspired me to do the record with him, and I called him as soon as I heard it, and I said, "Man, that's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard. Could we play spirituals together sometime?" And he said, "Charlie, I'd really love to do it. Let's do it." So we did it.
Why don't we hear that spiritual that you just mentioned, "It's Me, O Lord," and this is from an album of duets with my guest Charlie Hayden and pianist Hank Jones. The CD is called "Steal Away." My guest is bass player and composer Charlie Hayden, and this is from his recent album with Hank Jones called "Steal Away." You stopped singing as a child for a while because you stopped singing altogether because of polio?
Yeah, I had bulbar polio, which there was an epidemic going on in 52. And we were in Omaha, Nebraska. We had a television show there. This was right before my dad retired from music. And I got this virus, and it paralyzed. I was really lucky, actually, because most of the hospitals were filled with polio patients, and it was all paralyzed lung, function and legs, and mine hit my vocal cords for some reason, the left side of my throat and my face, and I eventually, the doctor said I was a very lucky guy, and I eventually got over it, but the thing that I couldn't do anymore, the range in my voice kind of left me. I couldn't sing. I loved singing, but I wasn't able to sing anymore.
So what's the connection between the polio and not being able to sing and learning to play bass?
Well, I really don't know if there's a connection. I was playing bass before I had polio. I was playing my brother's bass. He wouldn't let me play his bass, but every time I could sneak into where he kept the bass, I would go in and play it, And I love playing the bass with records that we had, when I was 14 in Omaha, I was in the ninth grade. They had an orchestra at school at North High, and the orchestra director wanted me to play bass. When he found out I play bass, he said, "We need another bass in the bass section of the orchestra." And I said, "I can't read music." And he said, "Well, I can teach you." So he took me down to the band room. His name was Sam Thomas. I'll never forget it, man. And he showed me the first page of the Simandl book, the bass method book, and all the open strings were there, and he said, "Now I want you to practice playing these with a bow. This is a G, this is a D, this is an A and an E, and practice this while I'm gone, and then we'll start on the half position, and we'll go to the first position to where you press down the strings, he said, "You're playing this anyway by ear, with the little band you have here at school, but now you're going to know how to read it." And I said, "Great." So he left the room, and I started getting real nervous, I mean, I got this anxiety attack. I said, "Oh my," I looked at these notes, and I was bowing, and all of a sudden I thought I was having a heart attack. And, can you imagine having a heart attack at 14? And so, man, I grabbed my chest, I put the bass down, I went out and ran out in the hall to the water fountain, and started drinking all this water, and a couple of students came up to me, my friends, said, "What in the world's wrong?" I said, "I think I'm having a heart attack." I said, "Charlie, you're out of your mind. You're not having a heart attack." I said, "I think I am." And Sam Thomas came back, and he was cracking up, man. He said, "You're not having a heart attack, Charlie. You're just, learning how to read music."
So did you finally overcome your fear about it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I played with the school orchestra. It was really great, and
that probably opened up a whole new world of music, too. Yeah. Music you'd only have access to if you could read.
That's right.
Well, Charlie, I'd like to go out with something from your new Quartet West album. And you end the album with something called "Now Is the Hour." It's the title track of the record. And you say it's a Maori farewell song. How did you learn this song? And tell us something about it.
I used to listen to this song on the radio during World War II. Bing Crosby recorded it, and it sold millions of records, and Vera Lynn, I believe, in England recorded it. It was a very well-known song during World War II because it depicted, the guy going off to war and his wife saying, when you come back, I'll be waiting for you, but we must say goodbye now, and I just love this song, and I have a lot of songs that I have from my childhood that I'm saving up to do with whatever band that I hear it with, and this was one of them. And then I was speaking to Alan Broadbent, who's from New Zealand, about the song, and he said, "That's a Maori folk farewell song." And I said, "Well, I guess that's where it came from." So I knew then what we had to do it, because Alan also was close to the song, and so we did.
Would you sing the song as you remember it?
Well, I'll try. Now is the hour when we must say goodbye. Soon you'll be sailing far across the sea. While you're away, oh, then remember me. When you return, you'll find me waiting here.
Charlie Hayden spoke with Terry Gross in 1996. Let's hear Now Is the Hour from his album of the same name. Charlie Hayden's Now Is the Hour. Coming up, Power Pop. This is Fresh Air. In an interview in 1966, Pete Townsend was asked to name the sort of music The Who played. Power pop is what we play, he answered. Townsend's term has since been applied to three decades of a certain kind of catchy rock song. Rhino Records has just put out a 3-CD collection of power pop touchstones called Poptopia. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Baby It's You is a power pop classic in a couple of ways. Beyond the fact that it's got an irresistible beat and a lot of energy, it was cut by someone who's no more than a footnote in rock history. In the 70s, Phil Seymour was a key player in the Dwight Twilley Band, itself a power pop cult band for the ages. Seymour put out a couple of solo albums, drummed for yet another fine power pop outfit, the Textones, and he died of lymphoma in 1993. Like the music itself, Seymour made his point and scrammed. He's a minor deity to 90s power poppers like the Jellyfish.
Though it's hard to admit it's true, I've come to depend on you. You and your angelic shout, loud enough for two. That is why.
Just can you wanna live this life?
Pete Townsend may have coined the term, but power pop owes its real origins to the early Beatles and lesser mortals like the Dave Clark Five, the Byrds, and the Beau Brummels. The salient characteristics of the genre are ringing guitars, keeningly high male lead voices, and lyrics that are primarily about being sensitive and heartbroken whenever they are not about being heartbroken and bitter. Listen to a song like She Goes Out With Everybody by the Sponge Tones from North Carolina, and you think you've stumbled across a lost Beatles single. CDs that make up Rhino Records' Poptopia contain 54 examples of power pop. Listen to them in one sitting and you'll feel as if your brain has become encrusted in sugar. Like any obsessive subgenre, power pop is best taken in small doses because it tends toward mannerism and baroque affectation, to say nothing of the occasional empty-headed nostalgia. And now that I've stated these sensible warnings, I'll also say that along with funk music, this is my absolute favorite rock and roll subdivision. I love power pop's fervent emotionalism and fierce lack of pretension. I love the fact that it can yield a song as beautiful and poetic as the Smithereens' Behind the Wall of Sleep. I could quibble with some of the selections on Poptopia. The cut by the great Zion, Illinois band Shoes is atypical and weak. And where is Los Angeles's brilliant contribution to 70s and 80s power pop, Walter Egan? This guy was the Raymond Chandler of the genre. But that's the fanatic in me talking. Poptopia is a highly useful survey. Fans of rock subdivisions like to feel embattled, to feel that the big, bad mass audience can never really appreciate the object of their veneration. But at a time when neo-power poppers like Oasis and Hanson are actually being played on the radio, the utopia of Poptopia may finally be achieved.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed a 3-CD collection of power pop songs called Poptopia by Rhino Records. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.